Hi, I'm Stacey Shimakarawan, Editor-in-Chief of Hospitality Design Magazine, with HD's What I've Learned podcast. Today, I sat down with the prolific and iconic chef, Daniel Blude. In our wide-ranging interview, we dove into his childhood in Lyon, France, the pedigree of chefs he worked with as he made a name for himself around the world, his career-defining time at Le Cirque, and the exciting yet challenging experience of opening up his namesake restaurant, Daniel. The success of the fine dining institution led to his growing food empire, but Daniel's influence reaches far outside of the kitchen, beyond Michelin stars and James Beard awards, and the countless hours he spends giving back to many different charities. He considers cultivating young talent one of his greatest accomplishments. While the industry may have to be reimagined in this new reality, he says, the one thing it won't lose is its talent, passion, and commitment. I'm here with Daniel Blude. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Stacey, for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, no, I'm so excited. How are you? How are you surviving this new crazy reality that we're all dealing with?
Well, it has been a long journey of worry, of course. It has been a long journey of trying to find a balance between life and work, and certainly, trying to dream of better days, but we have to be very patient. We have to be very cautious. And the biggest worry of all is, of course, the business. But what is the business most important thing is the staff.
Yeah.
And I think that was certainly something who had consumed us a lot in at the beginning by trying to find solution to support our teams. And so we created foundation, we reopened some kitchens. And today, about 3 months after, almost 3 months, we have been doing meals in New York, producing meals for different charity, but mostly City Meal on Wheels. And also we did a lot of meals for World Central Kitchen for many weeks when they were taking care of the nurses and the first responder here in New York during the high of COVID. And then after we opened the kitchen uptown at Daniel and also provided meals for hospital on the upper side of New York. And then from there, we started to take action on trying to bring a little bit of business or do something. And we started DBK. And Daniel Blude Kitchen was about, providing curbside pickup and delivery and grab and go. Not grab and go, but curbside pickup and delivery. With a menu which was certainly more casual than Restaurant Daniel, but at least a combination of our bistro menus and our more fine menu. And it has been good. And then since then, we opened a terrace at Daniel, and then we have opened Barboulou, and we have opened Epicerie. But I've never worked so hard. And, I get up in the morning and the first worry we have is to, start communicating to many of our, it's staff, it's suppliers, it's customers, and we try to find solution one by one. And, of course there have been a lot of coalition of restaurateur and chef. And, many people, I have spent my last 5 months on Zoom all day long. and that's not a good thing. It's I think, there's nothing better that being at work, being with the team, work with the team, and feel that sense of power together. which I think is very difficult to sense in with Zoom.
Yep. What do you think needs to be done to get the industry back on its feet, minus a vaccine, which would be nice?
I know the vaccine is the vaccine is number one, but right now it is obvious that first they were the PPP where there was one round, second round, third round, and I think every business we were able to apply and usually all the business got their PPP. I didn't hear anyone after the second round or after the second round. I didn't hear much that people didn't get because they really focused on the small businesses who really needed the help as well.
Right.
But at the same time, we need support. I mean, the landlords have been good and they have been very cooperative, but landlords need help. I think we'll have better news, I hope, within the months to come. But otherwise, it's going to be very challenging. I don't think many businesses can reopen at this point. And they talk about the stabilization fund where there will be some extra support for overhead or expenses beside payroll. Or I don't think they're going to do an extension of the PPP, but they may do an extension of the unemployment support from the federal government. So that will be good as well. But insurance, you know, we had a coalition called BIG, Business Interruption Group. And we had a business interruption with no precedent, and they were, and it's so important that insurance step in and at least in a way help business reopen.
Yeah.
But that's not done yet. And that is still a battle.
Yeah. And I mean, if they don't extend, the unemployment for these workers, I mean, that's the biggest concern, right? Because they can't go find another job. There are none.
Right now. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's such a gridlock there's absolutely, we don't know where the opportunity are to bring back more people when we don't know where the business can come back.
Right. All right. Well, I'm glad that you are staying afloat and pivoting.
We love what we do. We love to think about food. One thing we're not going to lose in this is our talent, our passion, our commitment, our dedication to hospitality and to cooking and to teaching and mentoring. And I think we just need to put it all back together.
Speaking of passion, I mean, let's pivot a little bit to you. And what did you always love to, I mean, you grew up on a farm in France, right?
Yes.
And so did you always have a love for cooking from an early age? Did your family, you know, cook together?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was a farm who was not specialized in one particular thing. We weren't doing just grain, or we weren't doing just animals or dairy. So it was a farm who was doing everything. So we were doing grain, but that was to feed our cows in the winter and our pigs and our goats and our chickens. We were doing hay to feed also the animals during the winter. We were doing goat cheese. We had 40 goats and 20 cows and 3 pigs. And the pigs, you know, you kill a pig and you have enough to eat for at least 4 months. Not every day, but, you know, between making the saucisson. I mean, the sausage will last a year for sure. Mm-hmm. And we were making our own wine, but we also were doing the farmer's market every week where we were raising a lot of chicken and duck and squab and guinea hen and turkey and rabbit as well, and baby goat during the spring. So there was all this cycle of life with food, with the life of the farm, the seasonality of it. And the food on that table was 99% our product, everything. We were making our own butter. We were making, you know, we had our own milk, our cows, the crème fraîche. The wow. So it's, I grew up every morning eating our own eggs and a slice of pork belly, you know, poached pork belly cold like this, nice, because that was, everything was coming from our farm, the young calf. When we had the young veal, some of them became, you know, livestock and cows, and some of them came to for us to enjoy on the table. It was always a feast, and it was always a big family. We were five children, plus my parents, my grandmother, mm-hmm. and some uncles or some relative who were helping at the farm at certain times. So sometimes the table could be from 8 to about 20. And of course, we were having two big meals a day, lunch and dinner. And so that was food was definitely the subject of life there.
Yeah. Was your mom and grandmother good cook, good yeah, chefs, good
yeah.
cooks?
Yeah. My grandmother was a great, great cook, and when I started cooking, because I started at 14, and when I started cooking, because I didn't want to be in the field, and I felt that it was really challenging, and it was not for me, the farm. Yeah. I was a little too preppy. I was a little too, you know what I mean? Dirty finger, dirty shoes all the time. That was not my thing. So I decided to become a chef. And my parents put me in a little technical college, a high school. I hated it. I hated it. And after 3 weeks in that high school, I told my mother, I say, you know, the teacher there is worse than you at home and worse than everyone I've known. And so I don't want to go to that school. The food is not good. So I had this neighbor of mine who was a contessa. And, you know, a contessa in the 60s or 70s, she was kind of out of a fantasy book. She was driving a convertible Mustang with a poodle next to her and a smoking Craven, but she was smoking this Craven cigarette with that little smoke pipe, you yeah. know, like the things. Yeah, the cigarette is like a 12-inch off your mouth, and she was always beautifully dressed and beautifully, and she lived in the village. And I would be, when I was a kid, 10 years old, 8, 10, 12, I will take my bike and bring her the eggs and the cream and the butter and the milk and the chickens and the things to her, because I will take my bike and just deliver. And she always loved me and loved my family. And when my mother told her that I wanted to be a chef, a cook, and she said, oh, well, I'm going to find him the best restaurant, because she was the best customer of all the 3-star and the 2-star in Lyon. And she had the horse racing. I mean, she had like a dozen of horses on the track in Lyon. She was gambling in the casino all the time. I mean, she was just burning down the fortune, but in a good way, in a fun way. So anyway, she was very helpful because she put me in a 2-star restaurant. And that's what started my life.
Wow.
As a chef.
And that was at Nandron, right?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And what was that like? I mean, did that just build your love for becoming a chef?
I was living by myself, basically, at 14. Wow. In Lyon, my parents were living about 45 minutes away from Lyon, outside in the countryside. And so I had an uncle who had a bedroom nearby his house and apartment there. And he had a charcuterie as well. So he was the brother of my mother. And so I was staying there in my sort of bachelor room. but I was 14, so that was super young. And then from there, on Saturday morning, Saturday the restaurant was closed, not more. So I was working 6 days a week at 14, from 8:30 in the morning until 2:30, and then come back at 5 until 10:30. And then on Saturday, that was my day off, but my father was coming to the farmer's market, and he was not far from where the restaurant was. So I would take the bus and go and work with him in the morning on Saturday, and then drive with him at home. And then the next day in the morning, and that what hurt me the most was Sunday morning to have to go back to work. Yeah. That was for me the hardest, because all my friends was going to go play soccer. They were going to go and have fun or go on weekend.
And you were going back to work.
Yeah. So that was, but that was life, and I never complained.
Yeah. That's amazing. And then you went on, somehow you just kept going to Michelin star restaurants, right? You went on to two others after that.
So, you know, without crying over my past, but from the age of 14 to 17, because I was an apprentice, my boss, who was closing the restaurant for a month and I'm sure was going in the south of France, was like, oh, Daniel, you don't need vacation. You should go and do a season in the southwest of France. I have a friend who has an hotel, because of course, all those places where they were very busy for June, July, August, they wanted cooks, and they called their friends in the cities and say, hey, can you send me a cook? Can you send me a cook? So of course I went to the southwest in Pays Basque, in Ascain, a small village in Ascain. I spent like 3 months there one summer. And that was my vacation. And then another summer, he put me to work at the municipal pool, the huge pool of Lyon, where there was a restaurant there. And I had to flip burgers and steak and fries. And like, I was just terrible. But I didn't know anything else but say yes, you know?
Yeah.
And so after that, I went on to, from there, because I was in a two-star, and the Relais Chateau, actually, which that was the beginning of my relationship with Relais Chateau, which is this association of the finest chef and small hotelier and innkeepers around the world. And so from there, that book made me dream, the Relais Chateau book. And so, of course, I was looking at where shall I go next. And I had set in my mind that I wanted to go to La Mer Blanc, which was actually a woman chef, a restaurant, but the son just took over after his mother, and she didn't have a daughter to be a chef. So the son was taking Georges Blanc at the time. And so I went to Georges Blanc. He had 2 stars. So that was a 2-star restaurant. I was very happy. I was the only kid coming from the city and being like, you know, trained by the tough guys and all that. And in the kitchen, there were about 4 ladies, and we were maybe 7 cooks or 8 cooks, and half of them were ladies. Mm-hmm. And but ladies like in age as well, who had been working with a mother before, and that was great to be in a real family environment rather than a, you know, this urban restaurant, macho restaurants in Lyon.
Right.
And I spent 2 years with Georges Blanc. And from there, I asked Georges Blanc. So I asked Nandron to send me to Georges Blanc. I asked Georges Blanc to send me to Roger Verger in the Moulin de Mouchin, south of France. So from Burgundy, I went to Provence, because Roger Verger just had 3 stars that year. In Moulin de Mougins, near Cannes. And I think he was one of the most charismatic chefs to work for in terms of personality, but in terms of cuisine, in terms of personality in the hospitality business as well. I love the man. And so I went there, and that was my first step really into the 3-star brigade kind of organization, big brigade, big team, and amazing things happening there. And so I did 2 years with him and learned so much. And
like what did you take away from that?
Well, of course, is the proximity of the market there. Of course, at George Blanc, we had local suppliers a lot, but we were still a bit isolated when it came about some unique product. But there in Provence, I mean, the ingredient was so beautiful. The smell, the taste, everything you grab, it didn't matter if there was a peach, if there was a fleur de courgette, or if there was strawberry or fraise des bois or anything, had so much freshness and smell, because it was just freshly picked and bring to you.
Right.
There were no transportation in between, basically. And I think also I learned, you know, a certain vibrancy in the food coming from Burgundy. There were many more vibrant flavor. There were combination with using a lot of vegetables, dishes using a lot of vegetable, which I love. Right. And I think may have stayed with me more. And they were also just the ambience of the team there. It was really high adrenaline in terms of you know, the work we were asked to do and the life we lived down there. We were partying all the time. We will have a break in the afternoon between let's say 2:30. And 5, and we will jump on our motorcycle and go straight to the beach and sleep for an hour and a half on the beach and then go back to work because we didn't sleep the whole night before. But besides that, it was also cooking there was really, really fabulous.
Yeah.
And at the time, Jean-Georges was just a village away at Outier. Or it was maybe a year after me around that time also. And also this community of talent we were surrounded by, and the community of chefs down there. And Roger Verger, one thing I loved about him is he was an art fanatic. He loved art. And you have to realize that he chose to go and live in Mougins because he loved that village. But Picasso was living there too, and many other great artists. And so... and the house of Picasso was about 300 feet away from the Moulin de Mougins. And so having lived part of his life with around this mecca of the artist mecca, and the Ecole de Nice also, where many artists came out from, he had this incredible relationship with artists. And, you know, he will feed the artist, but the artist will feed him with art. And they will throw parties and they will get together and I think I love that relationship of the artist and the chef.
Yeah.
And I think it has stayed with me, and I'm friend with many artists, and I think that was something which I always felt a genuine and natural connection.
Got it. That's amazing.
Because artists love good food.
Yeah. Do you think the art influenced his food too?
Yeah, of course. And because sometimes the artist influenced him by naming a dish after an artist.
Yeah.
Or by making a dish based on the artist's recipes. But also his food was definitely reflecting certain artists, you know, like he loved Armand. Armand was about sometimes accumulations and accumulation of one things, but in different place, and or the slicings of things, like when he was slicing violins or slicing. So I think you know, and he had sculpture everywhere. He was inspired by César as well. César was a very close friend. And César will entertain him with his art. And I think Roger will entertain César with his food in a way, then it was just very genuine, and those were the kind of artists also who will come to the Moulin and pick up junk, pick up matchbox. For example, I've seen César, taking matchbox and of the Moulin Mougin with a picture of Roger and all that. And then he made a piece of art with it by burning the matches in a way that it looked like a sun. And then there was the picture in the middle of Roger. And they were taking like old pots or silverware or things like that and bending it and compress it and making something for him.
Okay.
And, Armand was very good at compressing things.
Yeah.
So every time if Roger Verger had an old stove or an old thing he wanted to get rid of, he'd give it to Armand and then he would compress it and bring it back as a sculpture.
That's really cool.
So this idea of the compressé, many chefs was inspired by the artist.
Yeah. So, you had this great, life in South of France. What made you then move on to Copenhagen? Was that another kind of dream to go there?
Well, that was Roger Verger, because after 2 years with him, I felt I need to continue my Tour de France, and I continue my journey as a chef to learn, because I was 21, and I wanted to go back to Lyon, and I wanted to do another three star, such as Alain Chapelle in Lyon at the time, La Mère Charles, and Trois Gros, either one of the two. And Roger Verger said, "Oh, Daniel, I have a better idea for you. I am consulting in Denmark for this wonderful restaurant, hotel. And I knew the owner of it because he used to come to the Moulin Mougin. And he said, would you like to go as a sous chef there? And you will be the only one who will represent me, because you're the only one who work at the Moulin. But there'll be the team there, the brigade, and we're going to make the menu together." So basically send me as the executive sous chef there. And during the 2 years before, he was giving us, for whoever wanted to take it, English classes at Berlitz in Cannes. He was paying us for having English class at Berlitz. And I felt that was interesting. So I went to Berlitz to learn English. And little I knew, he knew it, and I had learned a little bit of English. So that's why he wanted to send me to Denmark. and he knew that I had no girlfriend, no string attached. I wanted to make him happy. And so I went there. And Denmark was a great experience. The hotel was fantastic. The restaurant was a Tradition Égalité and a Relais Château. And the owner had also some Relais Château in Denmark. The name was Sølvre Kro.
Okay.
So Copenhagen was a revelation, because for the first time I was out of France and working with a culture, with people who were really different than the French, and yet talented, and yet, you keep learning. You're curious about everything and curious about what they do, and you're interested by their tradition, by their custom, during holidays and all that. And Copenhagen was such an escape from France. It's so close,
right.
But there weren't that many French there. And French wasn't spoken so much. It was mostly English. So it was good for me to be able to practice my English and learn a little bit of Danish. But the ingredients were wonderful. And I think the customer were wonderful people as well. And I know the customer were wonderful people, but and I fell in love for a while in Copenhagen. But then I felt I was too young, and I still had this thing in my mind that I need to do another three star.
Okay.
Because I felt and I didn't finish my education well yet. I needed one more three star. And so that's when I decided to leave Copenhagen and go to Michel Gerard. But this time I didn't ask Roger Verger to go to Michel Gérard. I asked the chef of Michel Gérard, which I work with him at Roger Verger, and say, hey, do you have a job for me there? I want to come for the next season. It was open from March to November or something like that. And so I managed to go back to almost 10 months to do the whole year open of Michel Gérard at Eugénie Les Bains. And as much as Roger Verger was a traditional type of chef with an opportunity to evolve in Provence and create a style for himself and really combine cuisine classic and contemporary, Michel Gérard, he was a dreamer. He was an artist. He was a pastry chef to begin with, who became a chef. He was very avant-garde for the time. He was the one who opened his first restaurant in Agnières, and Agnières was like the Bushwick of Paris, or not even the Bushwick. I would say the Bronx of Paris.
Okay.
In a sense that there were a lot of blue collar living there. I don't want to say bad thing about any neighborhood, but there's certain neighborhood where you would have never imagined to have one of the best chefs in France opening a restaurant.
Right.
And he did there do that. And so much then, you know, the window, they were like little French window. So he will clean only the middle of the window. So it didn't look so fancy from the outside, the restaurant. And inside you had Jackie Onassis and you had the most powerful people of the world flocking there in Agnières, where they could barely walk into the streets, but at least they were going to Michel Gérard. And then when he married his wife, Biche Barthélémy, they moved to the southwest of France to Eugénie Les Bains, where Mrs. Gérard had a property there. And that's when they started Eugénie Les Bains. And so that was about 2 or 3 years after he was there. And he just had 3 stars the year before. And so that was something very important for me. And his artistic vision, his interpretation of French cuisine was really refreshing, very light, very, very precise. And at the same time, out of the box for mm-hmm. sure. And he was also the one who created Cuisine Masseur, where people were coming to the spa and the inn there and spend a couple of weeks losing weight. So we had a menu master every day for those guests. Mm-hmm. And but to this day, Chef Gérard is the most inspiring and the most creative chef. Is well in his 80s and still in the kitchen and still involved with his chefs and still making such an impact in his profession.
So you got the education that you wanted from him.
Yeah. And I would have continued with one more, but then after I was in love with a girl in Denmark. And so I came back to Denmark and then I went to the hotel, but I didn't like it anymore. It was not the same.
Okay.
And I wanted kind of to cut the rope with Roger Verger. So I went to work for a very young chef whose father was a famous restaurateur in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. But Jan Hurtigarden was just coming from some tour in Europe of restaurants, and he wanted to open his own restaurant. So I came as a young chef with him. And I did that for year and a half to help him start his new restaurants. And Jan, I still have a restaurant today in Copenhagen called Milke and Hurtigarden, or mm-hmm. Hurtigarden and Milke. And it was the first time that I worked in such a small restaurant, where we were only 4 in the kitchen or 5. It was kind of gastro. It was the beginning of the gastro bistro, where we made amazing food with a small menu making amazing food in a bistro style, but with amazing food. And I enjoy it, but then I got a call one day from a friend who said, "You want to go to America? I know they are looking for a private chef in Washington, D.C. And America was always a dream, because when I worked with Roger Verger or when I worked with Michel Gérard, Michel Gérard at the time had a restaurant in New York at the club, the nightclub called Regine.
Oh, okay.
And many of the chefs I work with, the young chef, had worked in New York, and they were telling me stories. And we had these American friends who came to Eugénie Les Bains to see us. And all this story made me dream of New York for sure, or America. And of course, at the time, Robert Mondavi was also starting to bring all those chefs from France to come and cook in Napa, in his estate, and to really entertain friends and locals with their talent, their wonderful things. And it was not a money thing. It was just friendship. And so, of course, I will always dream of going with them one day, but they never took me. So, because there was always like one or two cooks going with them,
right,
with the chefs. And so When I had this opportunity to come to Washington as a private chef in an embassy, I felt like I'm in, you know. I got a visa, I got a drive, I mean, I got a car, a visa, an apartment, and a bad salary, but that was okay, you know.
You finally came to New York a bit later, right, after being a private chef, and ended up at the Plaza, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Washington was fantastic, and that was the year where Jean-Louis Paladin was there. He just arrived the year before and is the one who really created the first restaurant modeled after a Perse or 11 Madison or Alinea, or with, you know, the tasting menu, which he will write every day. And I really felt that there was a shift in America. The early 80s was all this talent coming from Europe. But also all these American chefs studying in Europe and coming back home and starting to change things. Wolfgang Puck and Larry Forjon and all these chefs of this generation and Emeril and so it was the most exciting time to be here, because you could witness the you know, I mean, Patrick O'Connell, when I arrived in Washington, D.C., Patrick O'Connell was coming to the market twice a week or three times a week to Washington. And I will see him, and he was presented to me as this young American chef who does amazing things down there in the little Washington. And so, you know, you could see it, and they were definitely an evolution in talent of an emerging talent in America. And so coming to New York was something I wanted to do before I go back to France. And I did it, but I never went back to France. And so I came to the Westbury Hotel. Then I went to the Plaza Athénée, which was the same company. And I wanted to be the chef at the Westbury, but they thought I was too young. And they took a friend of mine to be the chef there, Patrice Boilly, and he's the guy who sent me to Washington, D.C. 2 years before. And he came to be the chef there. So with him, I was executive sous chef. Thomas Keller was line cook there at the time. He was the chef de partie. Excuse me, Thomas. He did some work before he went to Paris, and after he came back to Paris, I mean, he did a couple of trips to Paris and work at Taiwan, another place. But at the time, they were, you know, Alfred Portal was working also with us in the kitchen. Bill Yosses was in the kitchen. Ray Bradley, who today is a farmer upstate. Wow, was with us in the kitchen.
Such talent in one room.
And yeah, the corporate chef and partner, Ralph Scamadella of the Tao Group. The Tao Group, Ralph was there. Frank Crispo was there. I am maybe missing some, but it was amazing. those young American chefs who really became star on their own. And then after I moved to Plaza Atene, and there I had also some wonderful team. And I did it for 2 years, but then I had enough with the hotels in New York. I didn't want to be working for a restaurant in a hotel, but it served me well. I served them well. And I went around the block and came to Le Cirque.
So Le Cirque, I mean, that's where you got James Beard Award, New York Times. I mean, it's really where you started to get a ton of recognition. I mean, do you think that was where you really, I don't want to say this the wrong way, but do you think this is where you really kind of got into your craft and really started to?
Very much.
Yeah.
I think I, coming to Le Cirque, I jump on the big stage. And I think I will say that I work extremely hard there. And I arrived at Le Cirque, and there was an amazing team, but there was a change of guard. And some of the chefs working there wanted to move on, and so the transition was fine. But then after, and amazingly, I mean, Jeffrey Zakarian was sous chef there at Le Cirque. Michael LaMonaco was the chef there. But there was Mark Murphy had left a little bit before. But I have so many chefs who have been through Le Cirque with me. And but they were there, and Alain Sayac had leave and was moving on to a new opportunity. And so they all went with their chef, which was normal. And I brought my sous chef. So I started to make change into this sort of institution. And it was still really a time where many of the restaurants had a similar sort of menus, technique, very predictable. Either it was La Caravelle, Le Cygne, La Grenouille, le Périgord, La Côte Basque. There was similarity in their organization, in their execution, in their way of doing things. With Sirio, it was Italian, so there were like a little bit of Italian thing inside the menu for sure, but with Sergio Maccioni. And I think that's what interests me also, is then the same week, André Soltner of Lutèce and Sergio Maccioni of Le Cirque asking me if I want to be their chef.
Wow.
And with André, as much as I love André, and I'm always in admiration for his career and what he had built at Lutèce and all that, I knew that André was the chef. And for me to go there, it was fine, but I would not really be the chef the way I wanted to be the chef. And so coming to Le Cirque, of course, Sergio Maccioni was the boss, but he was not the chef. And I knew that I could really make my mark as a chef if I can succeed, because Le Cirque was certainly one of the hardest places to work in New York. I made it happen.
Why was it the hardest place to work in New York?
Because I think, you know, the expectation of the clientele, the expectation of of Sergio Maccioni, the labor condition were not easy as well. I mean, I will, you know, work very hard and yet still find time to do other things. I made a cookbook while I was there. I made a newsletter because with my wife, we felt like, you know, between, you know, 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock, maybe we could do things together. So, so we wrote a newsletter called Easy Cooking with Great Chef. Huh. And every month we had this 12-page letter where every month I was inviting another French chef. So it was Lydia Bastianich, or it was Thomas Keller, or Michel Richard, or Jean-Louis Paladin, or Jean-Georges. Every month I had a basket of ingredients, and I will be talking about the nutritional value, where it's from, what you can do with it, and all that. Then I will ask a chef to take this list of ingredients for the month of May and make me a menu with it.
Oh, cool.
And then I was doing also myself a couple of other a menu master, because I was doing a zero calorie, not zero calorie, but like a low calorie menu, you know, after Michel Gérard kind of inspiration, and then a family dish. And we did 12 issues. That was my days at Le Cirque, besides working 16 hours a day trying to have other projects.
That's amazing.
And then dreaming of opening my own place one day. So it took me 6 years, because, you know, when you don't have the money to open your own place, you have to make yourself a name in order to have people trust you to give you money. And I was very lucky on that part. I had five, six investors, and I had raised about half of what I needed. I needed about 2.5 million.
Wow.
And at the time, 27 years ago, and I had a hard time getting the rest of it. And I met a gentleman called Joel Smilo, and he was just retiring from Playtex as a CEO. Oh. He had made some very, very large donation to Yale University, to New York, NYU hospitals, you know, gifting buildings to them and all that. And he felt like he never had my cooking. He never really knew me, but he knew of me from his niece and nephew. And that's how I met him. And he felt like that'd be something interesting. And he told me, he said, you know, I'd rather be your partner than one of your partners. Because if you have 10 partners, it's always too complicated. So I'll do everything for you. And, you know, it facilitated everything, because it gave me the chance to really now look at a space and sign up a lease and start business.
Wow.
But that was my lucky strike.
Okay, so you opened Danielle. And what did you want to create? It had your name on it. You know, was this, what was your dream? What was your vision? And how did you bring that to life?
Well, yeah. So while I was at Le Cirque, and I think it was in 92, the James Beard, or maybe 91, 92, I won Best Chef of New York. And I was like stunned, because there were so many other big talents here who were supposed to be on stage. And for me, it was my first nomination. And I didn't know what to think of it. That gave me the confidence that I should continue to pursue my dream here, because 1989, when my daughter was born, we wanted to go back to France. I wanted to go back to Lyon. And I, for 2 years, two summers on the road while I was at Le Cirque, I was looking for a restaurant in Lyon. And I couldn't put it together. I didn't have the money to open, but at least I was trying to find money there to help me. And the banks didn't know much. My parents didn't have any money to do that. So I came back to New York. I did my work at Le Cirque. And I think the late 80s was bad in New York. And then it started to, we came out of the big crash of 89. And we 88, I think it was 88 or 89. And then the early 90s, 91, it was starting to be better. And that's when I made the full decision to say, forget about Lyon, let's concentrate on New York. And that's when I opened Danielle, signed up in 92, opened in 93, spring of 93. And Danielle, I wanted the place to be very personal. So, you know, we use all the family connection, all the friends, to build a restaurant as beautiful as possible and as cheap as possible. And I brought a team of wonderful people, François Payard, which came from Le Cirque, because I brought him from France to Le Cirque. Jacques Torres was at Le Cirque also, the pastry chef. Yeah. And then François after left me at Le Cirque and went to Le Bernardin for quite a while. And then he wanted to make a change again. And as I was opening Danielle, he wanted to come back. So we opened together Danielle, Alex Lee, who was a young chef working at Le Cirque with me. He was in France for a year and a half. I sent him to France and he went to Italy and Spain. And he was just coming back. And I proposed him to be the executive chef at Danielle at the time. And that was his first job as executive chef. So that was, and then after we built up a team and we opened Danielle, and the first review I had of the New York Times was from Marion Burroughs. Wow. And because she didn't like me, and it's okay, you know, some people like me, some people don't. So she gave me a terrible review. And I think, you know, coming out of Le Cirque with 4 stars twice, because that was the highest rating you could get at the New York Times. I came to Danielle. We opened this restaurant, and she came the early weeks of that, and she didn't give me a glowing review. And she gave me 1 star, maybe, or 2 star. 2 star, maybe. 2 star. I don't remember, but it was bad. It was not our expectation. And I told my team, I say, don't worry, we're going to show them the best stew they have ever seen. And we did get discouraged. The restaurant was packed to the nose and it was busy, but we were having an amazing fun. And then not knowing came, so we were doing our things. My cookbook just came out that year as well, Danielle, Cooking with Danielle Boulud. And I was doing a promotion in Washington, D.C., I think, a book tour in D.C. And my wife called me and said, you're not going to believe what the Herald Tribune printed today. You are number one restaurant in America and one of the top 10 in the world.
What? What does that feel like?
Yeah. And Herald Tribune, it was Patricia Wells, who at the time was living in Paris, an American living in Paris. And she was a food critic. She was even a food critic for a magazine in France called L'Express at the time. But she was also, her husband was a editor-in-chief of the Herald Tribune in Paris. And she decided that she should tour the world. I mean, she decided to make a year thing. Then every month she would choose one country and one restaurant to be the best restaurant of this country and one of the top 10 in the world. And so she did Italy, she did France. Joël Robuchon was number one at the time. She did England, she did USA, Japan. And the tally was moving. So I was number 3 in the world. Then I was number 4 and I finished 7 in the world. So, you know, for a restaurant who was 8 months old, I was pretty proud.
Yeah, I would say so.
So that was way before the 50 best and way before Michelin came here. And the amazing thing about the impact of the Herald Tribune is, and I will be in debt forever to Patricia Wells for having done that on a personal way without letting me know that she was reviewing my restaurant or telling me what she was doing. And you know, that those kind of rewards are very meaningful in a way. And after that, the impact of the Herald Tribune all over the world, I had a triple page in the Time of Bombay. I mean, imagine 1993, Time of Bombay, 3 page.
There you are.
places like you have never imagined you could be. And that was really that skyrocket. The restaurant. So at the time, Brian Miller left the time. the time was in limbo of critic. They didn't have yet found the critic. So Marion Burroughs was doing review. Sometimes Florence was doing review. Florence Fabricant. And then finally, they appointed Ruth Reichel coming from LA, the LA Times. And one of the first review, not the first, but within the first few months of Ruth here in New York, she came to Danielle and she gave me back 4 stars. And that was, you know, a dream come true because I didn't know who she was. I knew there was no politic involved. It was just like, you know, honest review and honest result. And I think that's those sometimes, you know, you feel like, oh, is there politics in all these guides and critics and reviewer? And is there, you know, opinions who are affecting their result or their opinion? And and so I think with Ruth, I was pretty impressed.
Yeah.
And very thankful.
Yeah.
Two women who made, who gave me the confidence that I was on the right path. I mean, between Patricia Wells and Ruth Reichel.
Right. Danielle has been around now for 27 years. I mean, that's unheard of, especially in New York. What do you think? And also Cafe Bleu, too, is 22 years. What do you credit to this longevity?
Well, I think good partner. I think good partners, my partner, Lily Linton, who has been with me for 27 years. Her uncle, step-uncle, which was Joel Smilo, who helped me in those years, during for at least 25 years out of the 28 or 24. And then the staff, of course, the talent of the staff over the years. I think those 27 years, if I accumulate the amount of staff who went through the to the door, but and did their time, and some of them are still with me, Jean-François Bruel and Eddie Leroux and Michael Lawrence. I mean, many of them are more than 20 years with me, the team, the suppliers, the loyalty of our suppliers is very important. But also the our loyalty to them, but also their loyalty in terms of helping us always, and the customer. The customer, the loyalty of our customer, the relationship we have with the customer, and how we don't take anything for granted. But management is very important, and I invest always a lot in people, in talent, and spend a lot of money on having also a good executive direction management. I think it's very important. And then and like I say, you know, my staff can testify it, and I'm not always happy. I'm hard to please, and I think as long as I'm hard to please, we make the effort to make the customer more happy and certainly sensitive to the work we do.
Right.
Because, like I say, I don't take anything for granted. It don't matter if it's our reputation or if it's our food or if it's the price we charge. I mean, you know, it's not because we are making fine food, then we have to be exorbitant in our price. Everything has a cost, but we try to always be in balance with ambitions and what we can do. Danielle has been some high and low, and it's not easy. But, you know, in the low, we have to push high. And in the high, we have to make sure we don't take advantage of it also. And I, you know, sometimes do I dream to have 3 star again, Michelin? Yes, but at the same time, it cannot haunt you and it cannot ruin you.
Right.
And we have to continue to live our passion and do our job the best way and make sure that we, you know, give some elbow push to the 3 star always. So, you know, when it comes to be a two-star restaurant in New York, we believe that we are the best two-star there is in New York.
Right.
So that means what? Are we as good as the three? Oh, yeah, I think so. Because I know what the three are worth. So.
I love you.
And it's maybe because Danielle take more risk than other, but we continue to take risk. And right now, after these COVID things, we're going to continue to take risk because our business, we can see how fragile the economy is and how fragile this business is. And maybe sometime I lost in my, in this, you know, ambitious endeavor of having a fine dining restaurant. You know, sometimes you lose a star here, you lose a star there, but I don't think we lose our passion and our dedication to take care of our customer first and foremost.
Right.
Because at the end is the customer who make the decision to come back, is the customer to make the decision to be loyal to a restaurant, and loyalty come not only because of me and my reputation, it comes from the team as well and the members of the team in the front of the house or the back of the house. And I love when a customer come and, you know, always make a point to come to say hello to the kitchen, but not only me, but the chefs as well. And it's so in a way, you know, this longevity is just like the first day. We just have to keep pushing.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think it's interesting too, how you have kept Danielle, the fine dining, very pristine isn't the right word, but you've kept Danielle and then you've expanded out, so, you know, Bar Bleu, you mentioned, DBD.
Oh, DB Bistro, DBGB, and Épicerie Boulou, which is Danielle at the cheapest level.
Great. More accessible for all.
Yeah, exactly. Why am I doing that? Why am I not just focusing on one and doing it perfect to the firmament of excellence? Because I enjoy our business at all level. And I enjoy the fact that to me, I love to go to a bistro. I love to go to a more casual place. I love to discover a cheap wine. I love to, you know, and so it's not all about this rarefied air we breathe in a three-star restaurant.
Right.
It's also about this wonderful communal this sort of wonderful, more casual places people can enjoy through our knowledge, our talent, and our teamwork, I would say.
Right, and you're in
because we use the talent of the fine dining restaurant to put into the more casual as well.
Right, which is smart because you're still delivering an amazing product, just at a different price point.
And also giving opportunity for young chef to become chef de cuisine, and that have springboard so many talent. So many young chefs in America by giving them the chance to be the first chef in our restaurants.
That's amazing.
Under our guidance, under our supervision. And I think that to me is the biggest reward. Mentorship is one of the biggest rewards in our business.
Well, I think that's so great how you give back. I mean, that's how you got to you, right? They just kept
exactly.
They kept passing you around.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in Florida, London, Miami, DC, Singapore. Is there anywhere else you want to go, or are you happy where you are? I mean,
we're opening a restaurant in Dubai in September at the Sofitel in Dubai, at the Sofitel Wifi in Dubai. And to me, this adventure out of New York, out of America, out of France, has always been so rewarding, so exciting. And to discover different culture, different ingredients to work with, different people to create a business with, and to really be able to also mentor in places like Singapore or places like China or London. Or, I think it's exciting. And maybe it's because I work with chefs like Roger Verger and Michel Guérard, who also were world travelers themselves and had restaurants all over the world, that I think it gave me the excitement to do that.
What do you love about opening a restaurant still?
I think the preparation phase, like right now, we are working on a new project at One Vanderbilt. And One Vanderbilt is going to be one of the most incredible projects opening in early 21, as you know, January, February 21. And working with all the trades, working with the architect, with the designer, with the engineer, with the so that's very exciting because you know, it's the again, it's like cooking, it's the accumulation of talent who creates things, and the power of creativity together that creates things. And and so I love that. I love the adrenaline of like putting a team together and opening a place. I think it's always an expression of yourself, but also of your team. And it's always a risk. And I think, you know, I work very hard to make sure that we calculate the risk carefully. But there's many restaurants who, you know, by the time you pay the investment, you don't really earn much money, but the restaurant make you happy.
Yeah.
And so that's okay. and it keeps people employed and it keeps the business vital. So it's important. Not every restaurant is, but you need to make profit. Every restaurant need to make profit because they can't survive otherwise.
Man.
You know, there is difficult time to go through. There is also, you know, there is high and low in our business. And you got to be able to weather the low. And if you don't have money aside for that, you cannot. You have to also reinvest constantly in a restaurant, constantly, with either in the furniture, either in the, you know, a machine will break or a chair will break. So it's really a business where we see the fragility today with this COVID and how difficult it is to reopen for everyone.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have, I mean, it's just like many people, you don't have 2 years of reserve in front of you to live on. You need your salary every day to be able to live on, and you save money for the future, but not to tap in the saving, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening with our business, is that no one had enough money saved to be able to say, well, I can live for 6 months closed.
How do you think, I mean, Danielle is known for its luxury and fine dining, and, you know, you've obviously diversified your portfolio and have other options, but how has fine dining changed in the industry's that you know, in terms of what you've been watching and what you've been paying attention to, and, you know, or what has been also one of the biggest changes in the industry that you've been paying attention to or that you are excited about? Or
I think today fine dining has definitely shown many aspects of a representation, from the small restaurant of 25 seats counter. You know, they call that fine they call that fine dining, but at the same time, it's more to me fine casual in a way of you know, eating fine food in a counter in front of the cook cooking the food. I think it's a concept for couples and for foodies and people who like to enjoy you know, going out for this type of experience. But I think fine dining, like a restaurant like Danielle or Le Bernardin or or many of those fine dining restaurants around the world, I think it still have a place to be and a place to give people the chance of having it's still an escape, I will say.
Yeah.
An escape, and it's not always about luxury. It's more about the refinement, the pampering in the service, in the food, in the setting, it is changing. It is changing, and we want to also keep changing. I believe that the old system might not work of fine dining with the big brigades of service and all that, and maybe the starchy kind of side of things, but still it is nothing. When I travel the world and I go to a restaurant where I feel that there's a crispness of excellence in where I am coming in and the moment I spend with my friends or family and the attention put on where we are and who we are with and what we are eating and what we are drinking. It's unique moments who stay with you for life. Mm. And those moments keep existing, but it's not everywhere that can happen.
Yeah. What would you tell a young chef today? What would be your greatest piece of advice for them?
Well, to continue to work for the best. And you'll be one of the best one day. But, you know, there's no escape. You have to pay your dues.
Yeah.
In order to. And I think in architecture is the same. In art is the same. And I think in so many ways, it don't matter if you are a dancer or if you are an actor. I mean, you have to be surrounded by the best talent around you in order to make something good out of yourself.
Yeah.
And then I do path after that. And I think we have seen that chef are the first one to be asked to support charities and to help their community. And I think for me, it has always been something very important as a New Yorker and as an American to, participate and support many, many causes.
Yes. No, that was going to be my next question. I mean, City Meal on Wheels has been one of your biggest charities. And what is it so special about that and giving back? And, you know, why is that so important to you?
I mean, and especially during COVID, I mean, yep. We saw how special City Meal was. City Meal served more than 2 million meals a year. And of that, at COVID, they quadrupled or quadruple the amount of meals they had to serve per day, and it was from 20,000 they went to 60,000, and triple their meals, City Meal was based on trying to give support to the elderly New Yorkers so they didn't have to end up in nursing home, or they could still remain in their home and get a warm meal every day. In the five neighborhoods of New York. So it's really New Yorkers who have always worked in this city, was part of the fiber of the city. And, I come from all walk of life and all, from all positions. I met people when I deliver meals with City Meals. I met people who were dancers, people who were actors, who worked in MTA, we worked in the field of restaurant. One person was a waiter as well in a restaurant in the 70s. And those people are, they are storyteller of New York, but they are also, they are important things to take care of. I mean, I support many other charity who are linked to children or linked to health or linked to many other things, but this one, I think it's because it touched the five boroughs and it really touched the community in New York, where today to be an older person is not easy because your family is not always there to take care of you.
Right.
I think City Meal bring that incredible support and that lifeline will make them live longer, live happier, live better.
And we always end the podcast with the title of it. So what I've learned. So what has been your greatest lesson or lessons learned along the way?
Well, my greatest lesson, I think, is certainly to never quit, to keep dreaming and never quit, because there'll always be, you know, opportunity, better days, and certainly there'll always be a new chapter in my life, but in the life of our community, of our city, our country. And I think we're entering a new chapter, so it's important for everyone to look at that as an opportunity and not, you know, down. So,
yeah.
So for me, it's not to take anything for granted and certainly never quit in that case.
Yes. Well, I love that. And I think it's a perfect place to stop. I can't thank you enough. I've enjoyed this immensely for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you. And look forward to book for you soon.
Thanks for listening to Hospitality Design's What I've Learned. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find full episodes and transcripts at hospitalitydesign.com.